It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and it's tape number 509, September the 6th, 1981. Libyan leader Gaddafi gave a warning to the Western nations, and particularly Ronald Reagan, and he threatened to attack American nuclear bases in the Mediterranean if the U.S. Navy challenges his control of the Gulf of Sidra. He's warned the people of Sicily, Crete, Turkey, and all states of the Mediterranean that if the United States provokes him, he will intentionally attack a nuclear deposit in these various countries and cause an international catastrophe. He said, we are willing to die for the Gulf of Sidra. We will make the Gulf of Sidra a new Red Sea with our blood. The interesting thing about this article is that I don't believe foreign policy is going to be made much longer in the White House with the struggling people there, Mr. Baker and Mr. Meese and Deaver and Haig, Allens, Stessel, the whole gang that I've mentioned many, many weeks on these programs and itemized them. And I'll do a little more later pertaining to another article in foreign policy of Ronald Reagan if I have time. I think foreign policy is going to be made quietly by both our allies and our enemies, and the boundaries that Ronald Reagan is going to be able to move will be decided in many ways by a group of people, whether it's suicidal, kamikaze, or whatever. He will push these people to the brink, and they have nothing to lose, and they will gain their own international, national pride. And Gaddafi has given fair warning that he will, in quotes, intentionally attack the nuclear depots. Now, when you have a man as President of the United States with a gang around him, such as Caspar Weinberger and Alexander Haig, it is our responsibility to let them know what you think and feel, because when they provoke these suicidal teams, our oil is cut off, hundreds of thousands or millions of people can die from nuclear intentional accidents. We could escalate a war that brings all of us in. When you get men who are idiots, who have fire in their teeth, who make tremendous profits out of war, out of weapons, out of selling ammunition to both sides, when you get people that have been put in political office for the sole purpose of World War III, and don't be deceived by that big smile that Ronald Reagan has. When they're there for that purpose, they'll drag you to the lowest level of their low mentality, and there's nothing lower than this gang. It's up to you to let them know, and for me to let them know, that I don't appreciate their provoking people to the brink of the kind of accidents that are going to be intentional. There's a new book out. I don't have it yet. I just got the title this week. It is available, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, written and mentions his friend Edward R. Murrow, the late radiocaster who I believe was murdered, and I may do more on that at another time. He was a friend of Murrow's and discussed many times Martin Bormann, the Nazi, with Murrow. This book is put out by Lyle Stewart. It's $14.95. It is on the list of research, the list of books that are available for various people interested in this entire era from the end of World War I to the present date and the causes for so much pain and for the pain that's going to follow. In this book, in essence, I was told that it mentions about 750 companies that Bormann figured if the Nazis controlled after World War II, they could control the world. And primarily, this book is about IG Farben. Now, that's an interesting corporation to begin with in wanting to control the world. They not only had offices in Germany, but they had them in New Jersey. And George Corcola, who set up the assassination teams with Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson and Theodore Shackley and the CIA, and we'll do more on that later, his headquarters are in New Jersey. Standard Oil New Jersey has had a link to a lot of the political operations that are national and international to a great extent. The Polish Pope, the present Pope that was put into power, worked for IG Farben. It was the branch of Farben at that time was called Solvay, chemical at Auschwitz that made the gas for extermination of not only Jews, but all kinds of people at Auschwitz. This pope worked at Solvay for Solvay, which was I.G. Farben, and he went on to become the leader of the Catholic world, and that's a large mass of population. As I say, he began his career under the Nazis working for I.G. Farben. It's interesting, when I learned about this book, I was told by Tom Davis that much of what I've been saying on these various programs, on the air every week, and putting together my research is confirmed, unfortunately confirmed, in his book on Martin Bormann. It tells how he retrenched in 1944 to organize the Odessa, the Spider, the German Nazi network around the world and put into corporations. I could name a large group of corporations that would fall into the 750, such as General Motors and U.S. Steel and Nestle's chocolate and ITT, and particularly defense industries such as the Hughes aircraft. I believe that after 1957, Howard Hughes was kidnapped and literally removed by 1966 from the scene and never seen again by anybody in this country. And the entire Hughes aerospace, the Hughes airplanes, the Hughes Medical Institute, was a cover for assassination teams and for the Nazification of America. Now, I've been pointed in the United States, this particular method of getting rid of politicians, whether it's John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, or Martin Luther King, or Malcolm X, or getting down to the Chappaquiddick affair where Hunt and Liddy and Tony Lasswitz worked for Howard Hughes when Hughes was non-existent, the entire Watergate team, the plumbers, the COINTEL program, all working under the umbrella of the Hughes organization. I can pinpoint that particular organization, and if you had the Hughes organization, I.G. Farben, and maybe 40 companies, you could control the world. Bechtel in San Francisco, that's international, and so forth. But this book mentions not all of the companies, but the fact that these Nazis under Martin Bormann decided by 1944, and the war was officially over by 1945, that they would have their gold and wealth out of Germany and the means and communication to continue the Fourth Reich when the other war scaled down. There was another article, I'm going to skip to a subject which is dear to my heart and important, always having to do with the Kennedy assassination, because when I started to find out who killed John Kennedy, that tapped right into Nazi spies and Nazis as early as 1964. I'd made those connections. This last week, there was a UPI Associated Press story with the title, Soviet Diplomat, the Spy May Have Fooled the FBI. This has to do with the famous Yuri Nosenko, a man who came to the United States and was sequestered away from the Warren Commission and kept secret. He's on the pay of the CIA at the present time. But there's a book coming out now saying that Yuri Nosenko worked for Moscow and the KGB and that he fooled the FBI when he came to this country. And it's a book of disinformation. The Reader's Digest is publishing the segments this October about Yuri Nosenko, N-O-S-E-N-K-O. Reader's Digest also published a book by Edward J. Epstein, Inquest, which was an apology. Half the book was accurate, and half the book was an apology for the Warren Commission and said they did a good job. They also hired Poinchetta Pierce, that notorious woman involved with the Nelson Rockefeller murder who called for the ambulance and then disappeared, who helped out Megan Marshak. And they also hired Alex Haley, who wrote a book on Malcolm X that covered up that murder. The Kennedy murder, the Nelson Rockefeller murder, the Malcolm X were all CIA, and the Reader's Digest hired writers and exposed disinformation on all of these murders. Now they're doing a segment of a book called Shadron, The Spy Who Never Came Back by Henry Hurt, which is a series of disinformation and lies, I can tell you in advance, because Yuri Nosenko was not a KGB defector from the Soviet Union who really stayed a Soviet spy and worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and fooled J. Edgar Hoover about who he was. This is entirely a false story. If any of you are interested or have the book by Bernard Fensterwald called Coincidence or Conspiracy. It came out in 1977. He has a section on Yuri Nosenko, a top Soviet intelligence agent who defected to the United States. And Fensterwald describes some of Nosenko's activities and has a photograph of him on page 223, but doesn't go into as much detail as Fensterwald could on Yuri Nosenko. In this book, however, that he wrote on the John Kennedy assassination, he said that among the Nosenko files, it was known that there was a consuming interest of the CIA into Yuri Nosenko and Lee Harvey Oswald. And Nosenko commented the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald might be a sleeper agent for the American intelligence. And this is, in fact, the truth. What Nosenko was saying for his own identity and for hundreds of thousands of dollars that he was paid later, he let out a little hint of what he knew, that he worked with the Oswald file in the Soviet Union. And Nosenko actually is a very important person because he is the link of Lee Harvey Oswald to Navy intelligence and the U-2 flights when Lee Harvey Oswald was stationed in an intelligence activity in the Soviet Union. Now, Bernard Fensterwald mentions several times the role that the CIA had in persuading the Rockefeller Committee, this is at the time of Watergate, to keep Nosenko's identity secret, and how Daniel Shore, the newsman, was fired from CBS when he was in the process of talking about Yuri Nosenko and the role that Nosenko had in hinting of Lee Harvey Oswald being a possible CIA agent in the Soviet Union. They kept that out of the Rockefeller report. Sylvia Marr, in her index of the John Kennedy assassinations, has indexed the House Select Committee hearings on Yuri Nosenko. And if you want to look those up, in Volume 2, page 436 to 536, there are pages and references to Nosenko. Nosenko was contacting the Central Intelligence Agency, even though his cover was KGB, in June of 62. That was after Lee and Marina Oswald landed in the United States of America. He made his first contacts because he worked on the Oswald file, and as hinted, Oswald was in the CIA when he was in the Soviet Union. January 23, 1964, 2 months after Kennedy was killed, Nosenko was in Geneva, and he contacted the CIA and said, "Bring me to the United States." He didn't go back to Russia. In 1964, April 4, 1964, he was brought to the Washington, Maryland area, and he was kept from the Warren Commission and from members of the commission so that the FBI and CIA never asked Yuri Nosenko any of the information about his relationship to the Central Intelligence Agency and Oswald's role to the CIA, even though Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission, who was director of the CIA, of course, knew all about it. They carefully kept every bit out of the first investigation, the Warren Commission report, which was 552 witnesses and 26 volumes of witness testimony and exhibit. Didn't have a hint of Nosenko. But when the House Select Committee on Assassinations did their work in 1978, the conditions that they could bring up Nosenko's name was that John Hart of the CIA could talk about Nosenko before the House Select Committee on the condition that they don't mention Lee Harvey Oswald. They could only mention Nosenko, and Congressman Dodd said, "You've talked for an hour and a half, and wasn't the purpose of your being here to talk about Oswald?" And Hart said, "I will not discuss Lee Harvey Oswald and Nosenko. If they expect me to do that, I would leave." So Nosenko is now, right now, a very well-paid agent of the CIA. He's not KGB. If he were what this book says he is, the Reader's Digest, he wouldn't be paid by the CIA. He got a huge sum of money by staying sequestered away for many years. And he had a home on the shore with a yacht and boat. And a man used to visit him. He used to come down from New England to visit him, and the man was John Paisley. Paisley was the CIA agent of Navy intelligence for the National Security Council and National Security Agency that was in charge of the Soviet division. Marianne Paisley and her husband, John Paisley, were paymasters and activists with spies like Oswald who went to the Soviet Union as defectors but were with Navy intelligence and doing jobs like grounding the U-2 to cause the Danton or the discussions of peace between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Oswald could be very useful. And along with them were John and Mary Hart. The four of them were in the Soviet division, and John Paisley was killed at the time of the hearings of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and Bernard Fensterwald, the gentleman who wrote this book, who headed the committee to investigate assassinations, who was James McCord's attorney at the time of Watergate when they broke that story open about the covering up of Nixon's team. Fensterwald has worked with the CIA all of his life, and he represents Mrs. Paisley. She has questioned whether her husband did in fact die. At the time, they said he was murdered. His hands and fingers were cut off, and there was no identity, and she couldn't see the body. But Paisley had a direct radio communication to Australia and was involved with the CIA and that famous Nugan-Hand Bank that I keep referring to that collapsed. He was working with Edwin Wilson, the men I talk about often on the air here, people involved with the killing of Allende, with Letelier in Washington, D.C., the major assassination teams. This Paisley gang and the Hart gang and the CIA are all molded to this ball of wax, and it's very important that new books come out keeping Nosenko on the KGB burner, because this is the bottom line of who killed John Kennedy. The answers are all there, and the people who were involved in this scheme to kill the president or other candidates, their names are surfacing in the news every single day for various researchers who know what to see and what to look for. But as soon as the Nugan-Hand Bank collapsed, John Paisley's name was linked to it. His photograph was in the London Times. And the CIA gang, from the Bay of Pigs on up through just to the present day, continuous murders and assassinations, have a link of agents and meeting places. And they've covered it so well up to the present date, but they haven't covered it well enough. And that's why new books come out on matters such as Nosenko fooling the FBI. He didn't fool the FBI, and everybody in Washington in the intelligence community knows who he is. Back in January of 1979, I did four radio tapes or more on Yuri Nosenko on the House Select Committee on Assassinations. One was tape 373, if you want to order those. Another one was tape 372, January the 19th, 1979. And I asked on that hour on the radio, what does Congress and the Justice Department have to conceal? The links of the KGB, CIA agents inside the Soviet Union, the web of Reinhard Gehlen's agents and the Nazi spies from Argentina to Minsk to the United States, the links of Leon Marina Oswald, agents of Navy intelligence and the CIA. And then I referred to the testimony of John Hart on Yuri Nosenko and the very important person that he was, a connecting link to the United States intelligence, military intelligence, to agents such as Lee and Marina Oswald. Now, Marina is a woman who has worn off her brainwashing that Priscilla Johnson and the others did on her. She's very lucid. She's very aware of the traps they've put her in. I just talked to her today, as a matter of fact, on some very important matters. And Marina Oswald understands now that the KGB doesn't do all of the things that the United States media says it does. And she used the expression, why don't we clean up our own house and look at the CIA and FBI? When she came to this country, she was worried that the KGB wiretapped or bugged or listened or spied and that Russia was filled with spies. Then she learned that ever since she arrived in this country, her telephone's been tapped, her neighbor moved across the street to put her under surveillance, and that almost every person that she contacted who offered to help her was from the Defense Department and the intelligence community. And luckily, she's a bright woman, and she's catching on. And it won't be too many years, as I say before, you'll see headlines on some of these characters, but they're trying to cover it up. Another attempt to cover up. The ministers of propaganda were working so hard this week. I guess you saw the stories. A British TV show claimed that the people who planned to kill the Pope, the assassination attempt, were from the KGB. This was in the London Times, and a long story about plans to kill the Pope, and they tried to pin Jah, the man who shot at the Pope, as being part of KGB. Now, there isn't a piece of evidence to support that. And one of the quotations they had for a program called TVI was an Italian journalist, Francesco De Andrea, who worked with a newspaper that was actually named with the Licio Gelli scandal, of the man who fled Italy with that P2 scandal that hasn't even really begun to burst open with its worldwide implications of, again, Nazi links, the John Hinckley that shot at Ronald Reagan, or Muhammad Ajah that shot at the Pope, strong links to an international Nazi group that Martin Bormann set up years ago. So they're trying to blame the KGB for the shooting of the Pope. The working theory that they held was, how could it be anybody else? It would have to be KGB because nobody else would want to shoot the Pope. That was TVI, a theory that the KGB was involved. Now, the Vatican responded and said the KGB did not become a suspect in the attempted murder of the Pope. They have seen no evidence of it. They know that Ajah had accomplices. And they are also looking, this is from the Vatican, that individuals have blamed the CIA as well as the KGB and a fascist Turkish group, even Gaddafi and the Libyan leader Gaddafi. Now, an article in the San Jose Mercury just today said the U.S. Embassy in Rome formally protested last month when the Soviet Union distributed in Italy a magazine called Today, which said the CIA had interest in removing the Pope. They said the Pope would have disagreed on U.S. policy in El Salvador, and the United States had to get rid of them. Well, one of the programs that I gave on the shooting of the Pope and the motives for possible assailants to kill the Pope, one was a Muslim-Christian war, and I ruled that out. The other is a far-right group, more fascist than most military governments, who wants no interference with a possible bloodbath in Central America, El Salvador, the Honduras, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Now, I put that down as a possible reason. I had five reasons on a tape I did May 17th on this program, giving five reasons and motives to develop on the possible shooting of the Pope. And one of them was what the Soviet Union was saying, that he would object to the way that we are decapitating and mutilating and killing. And El Salvador isn't the only country that is going to spread through all of Central America. Another motive I gave was the Protestant versus the Catholic motive. There's a strong dislike of the power of the Catholic Church, and that goes into, again, Licio Gelli, the Freemasons, the fascists. Gelli worked with Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, and Perón, and even though some of those were Catholic, there is a large group of Carl McIntyre and a group from Texas and Florida and the Sun Belt who object to the Pope. Also, interference with the narcotics war that is going on between hierarchy in the United States that involves Michael Sindona, who was the treasurer for the Vatican money and invested Vatican money into organized crime, into the Gambino family, and the Vatican is losing many, many millions every month. I had a list of possible motives, and one of them in a newspaper put out in Rome coincided with one of the motives that I had. It could be a combination of motives, but I doubt that the KGB would accomplish a thing. They claim that he was going to go to the shooting, the funeral, rather, in Poland of his close friend, and that he would have made a resurgence of the feeling of the church against the communist countries, that his presence in Poland would be a threat to that powder keg that is going on. Well, that powder keg is indeed instigated the solidarity with money from United States labor movements and the Central Intelligence Agency. But one more trip to Poland wouldn't tilt the balance, because the Soviet Union isn't going to give up Poland after being attacked in two wars any more than Libya is going to be attacked any more by the United States presence just inches off their water. So the story that the KGB tried to shoot the Pope is ridiculous, and there is not a bit of evidence on that score, but there is a lot more evidence of a link of the Pope to Michael Sindona and the investigation of Sindona that took place just 2 days before the Pope was shot, going to Licia Gelli, the link of the Vatican investor with a man who was involved with Martin Bormann and the Nazis of Argentina and down in South America in Uruguay. This Licia Gelli has dual citizenship and works with the closest assassination teams, the death squads in Argentina and Uruguay. And Licia Gelli worked with Michael Sindona and organized crime families, and Sindona was a financier for the Vatican. So when the Gelli story was breaking and Licia Gelli fled down to Argentina and hasn't been seen since, his daughter was arrested and held, and she had papers linking the CIA to her father and Sindona, and Sindona's link to the mafia. That's the ball of wax that tried to silence the Pope, I believe, and to kill the Pope, not the KGB. There were more reasons to think that this was a mob hit because of the entanglement of the Nazis and the drug dealers and the Vatican than there is to think that the KGB would want to shoot them. In fact, the KGB can sit back if they do any research and enjoy the entanglement of the Roman Catholic Vatican caught with the Gambino organized crime family. Sindona's been charged with murder of judges and investigators in Milan and the entanglement to the fascists down in Argentina and Uruguay. And Licia Gelli was at the inauguration of Ronald Reagan and funds the Republican Party to its teeth. And then they send people like Frank Sinatra down to Argentina for $1 million concert and South Africa for $2 million, probably filling in the Gelli fund that has to be floating. I can't say for sure, but Sinatra picks up these tremendous fees and is closely linked to Argentine connections. Now, to the KGB, we get more pleasure, I think, out of seeing this all fall down than take a chance that somebody in the Soviet Union would shoot the Pope. As I said before, if you shoot one Pope, you get another Pope, and there isn't much he's going to do with those people in Poland. They're going to have to get to work and work out their own problems, and I don't think that it has to do with that. Another article which links into these stories, I'll start it, and then we'll do more on the second half hour of this program. It's from the Washington Post, Wednesday, August 19th, called French Socialists Seek to Solve the Slaying of Alleged Spy Master. Now, this is a fascinating story that, again, links and goes into Licia Gelli in Rome and the shooting of the Pope, even though the killing of this particular man was a few years ago. In essence, this is the story of a Frenchman named Henri Curiel, C-U-R-I-E-L, and he's been compared to Dreyfus and the Dreyfus Affair because he's Jewish, and he was murdered and smeared before he was murdered and tried to be linked to the KGB. Again, like they say, the assailant would be assailant of the Pope was linked to the KGB, or Yuri Nisenko to the KGB. Now, this murder took place at a time when Curiel had an organization in France to help the Third World, and the job he was doing was exposing undemocratic fascist takeover of the Third World countries. I guess you would call Gaddafi a Third World country, and then when the CIA pours millions of dollars into equipment and training and literally takes over a lot of the machinery, they turn that country into a fascist country. In summary, in the United States, after World War II was over, Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's intelligence, made up a hidden government in our country, in the United States, and called it the National Security Council and the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA. In Italy, Licia Gelli, at identical time, had a hidden government that was planning coup d'etats and to put fascism in power, similar to the coup we had in Dallas or the killing of Robert Kennedy before he could become president. And he set up terrors and murders linked to this Gehlen group. And in France, Valerie Giscard d'Estaing, also with his special intelligence, his domestic called the DST and his international SDECE, were all linked, and again with Great Britain. Underneath the belly of every so-called democratic country and these NATO allies are a group of Nazi fascists, getting back again to what this Bormann book is about, is a network of Nazis waiting to control the world. And in France, they took this man who wanted to help countries get on their own feet and smeared him as being a suspected KGB spy. And the same people that did the work, who wrote books about him and linked them, are people in the news today who are prominent, trying to blame terrorism on the KGB when actually there isn't a day that goes by that terrorism isn't coming out from the bowels of the CIA. We'll take a break for 1 minute, and I'm going back to this case because of the parallels that are running through each of these countries.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.